Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Changes Revisited. My name is Annie McManus. Happy Easter Monday. I hope you are stuffing your face with chocolate if you are that way inclined. And I hope that this Easter bank holiday weekend has provided you with some nice restful moments. I'm very happy to be able to give you something now to accompany this Easter bank holiday weekend and week. And that is a Changes Revisited episode featuring one of our favourite comedians and one of our favourite musicians and producers. I'm talking about Joe Lycett and Mark Ronson. Now, Joe Lycett appeared on the podcast last May before all the shenanigans with David Beckham. If you missed that, Joe appeared to shred £10,000 of cash when David didn't pull out of his deal with Qatar during the World Cup, despite the criticism against the country's history with human rights and homosexuality being illegal. It turned out Joe had shredded fake money, and instead the £10,000 went to LGBTQ+ charities. It made headlines everywhere and sparked lots of conversation. It also highlighted once again Joe's ability to use his platform for activism. When he was on Changes last May, it wasn't too long after he had been in the press for having tweeted a fake Sue Gray report, the official inquiry into the lockdown socialising in government buildings, otherwise known as Partygate. Joe had managed to scare the government into thinking that the real report had been leaked. It was hilarious. He was also touring his show More, 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 How Do You Lycett, How Do You Lycett, which is now available to buy and stream on his website, joelycett.com. He spoke about the show in the episode and how it, again, very cleverly makes people laugh whilst also highlighting issues within LGBTQ+ communities and pushing for openness, acceptance and celebration. I asked Joe when he realised that this was something he could do and if there was a light bulb moment when he realised that he could enact change through being a comedian.
That's very nice of you to say. I would dispute that it's all activism when
yes.
I'm sort of talking about my cock and balls.
Yes.
Slightly slightly less activist that.
Yeah.
But there is definitely increasingly a slant in it. I did an interview with Eva Wiseman in The Observer a few weeks ago, and I was saying I'm not a political comedian. She was like, you are. And I just don't think of myself as a political comedian because I think of, you know, your Andy Zaltzmans and your Nish Kumars and people who actually are, you know, doing political stand-up and really brilliant political work. I don't feel like that, but the more I do recently particularly, the more I realise I'm sort of accidentally a political comedian, but in the way that we're all sort of accidentally having to become political because of the state of politics in the country at the minute. Like,
right.
I didn't want to be talking about this because I don't want to be cross about these things. I want these things to be done properly. But the government that we have in currently, and even just the fact that I'm talking to you about this publicly on a podcast, I never used to talk about my political leanings, never mentioned who I voted for. I would always try and take the piss out of everyone. But the current batch of politicians in power are so seem to be me so immoral and so corrupt and so out for their own gains that we're all forced to kind of we're watching so many of our institutions sort of break down around us that you don't really have a choice. You have to sort of pick a side for want of a it's I don't think it's a binary quite like that, but you do have to sort of go like, at what point do I go, I'm not happy with this. The thing that I realised I wanted to talk about was when Dominic Cummings was fanning about. When he's going on his drive. And obviously I was cross about that like everyone else was because it was, double standards of the government. But also I had this other thing with my friend who died in lockdown and, you know, didn't get to see him when he died. And I'd been with him for a long time and up until that point, but was playing everything by the rules, had a small funeral, all of those things. And this prick's like fanning off with his family to Barnard Castle. But I was so cross that I couldn't use it well. I couldn't use it properly. Yeah. And so it was like, actually, I can't. I just come across as that, you know, when sometimes you're just so angry, you just sort of end up just going like, oh, and you're a knob, you know, just like you don't articulate yourself well because you're so cross.
Yeah.
And actually, I just knew that I needed to sit with it. And then obviously when Partygate came out and all of that, that was the sort of catalyst for me kind of talking about it a bit more openly and a bit more, with a bit more bite and spice to it, I suppose. Mm. Before that, I suppose I was doing a lot of activist-y sort of stuff. It's more like just being a bit irritating for companies and that kind of thing when I do Got Your Back and the documentary I made about Shell and all that. It's like, yeah. But it's, I think for that side of things, it's very addictive, Annie, being like righteous. And sort of going like, I know what's right and wrong, and I'm going to tell these baddies what's right and wrong. And that's, I suppose, why we love watching kind of action films where the goodie wins and the baddie, you know, gets, you know, knocked over or whatever. I've sort of put myself in this sort of goodie role, which I realise is a very dangerous place to be, because the minute you step out of line even a little bit, they're coming for you. And I'm sure I'll be eradicated by some stupid something or other at some point, but yeah, it just became very addictive, really. So it's sort of mainly just I love the thrill of it. I love whatever chemical goes. I don't take drugs. I enjoy a glass of wine, but whatever chemical is released when I say to an audience something about something I've done, which, you know, has pissed off a insurance company or something like that, I love that chemical. And that's what I'm going for, really. It's not any altruistic desire to do right or whatever. It's just literally I want my fix, and that's how I get it.
I mean, there is that, I suppose, the kind of very straightforward, like, me against the enemy, you know, good, bad. There is a kind of binary aspect to Joe Lysa's Got Your Back and all that. But then in your stand-up, it is way more personal and way more nuanced, and you explain stuff in a way that is very patient and kind of so relatable. So, you know, you're talking to an entire audience about pansexuality or whatever. Yeah. And there's a kind of way that you do things where it's wrapped up in kind of personal self-deprecation and also just curiosity. You just invite everyone in, I suppose. And I think that's a really powerful way of opening people's minds. And I don't mean to say that everyone that comes to your gig is some sort of Neanderthal. But do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, it's just
they can
it's
be.
Creating
they
a conversation,
be.
You know.
Yeah, well, that word curiosity is interesting, because I always think that when I sort of see people sort of, particularly around LGBTQ stuff, saying like, oh God, there's another letter, is there? Oh, we have to add another letter, do we now? That is a lack of curiosity. It's a real void of curiosity to sort of say, can we just have the four letters now? It's like the world is so full of amazing things. I mean, there's hundreds of countries, and we're not saying, like, oh, can we not just have two? You know, it's like there's so much wonder and diversity and nuance to life, and that's what makes life exciting and brilliant. Why not allow ourselves as humans to have that? Why sort of restrict ourselves to being, you know, binaries and all these things? And I know it sounds all nonsense and left. And this is the other thing, is like, I try not to take any of it too seriously, because essentially I'll be dead before I know it, and so will the rest of us. So it's like, I try not to get too bogged down in any of it, really. But I do find it extraordinary when I sort of hear from people when they sort of say like, oh, I can't be bothered with this they and them stuff. It's he or she. And I think, why? Why can't you be bothered? What part of your life? Why are you so bored of life? Why not be excited by this? Like, it just seems so... It seems strange to me. I sort of pity them, really, if anything. They are not excited by the possibility that things could be different.
Were you always this curious person? Were you a curious kid as well?
I don't know, actually. I just realised I'd just done a diatribe about they and them whilst pouring light oat milk into my coffee. What have I become? What have I become?
Listen, that's my favourite oat milk too.
Again, another reason for diversity.
Exactly.
We all thought, oh, they've done it with almond. And then we thought, oh, soy. God, it's got to be soy. And then they brought out oat. What next?
There's rice.
And I'll have it. Whatever next, I'll try it, and I'll probably fall in love with it. Yeah. I'm into it. Was I into?
So, like, I'm imagining you as a little kid writing letters to people. And what were you like in school and as a kid?
I really wanted to be friends with the teachers. I was that prick. All of my friends were like older. I was like hung out with the older kids. I wasn't anti-authority in the way that I am now, I suppose. But I think it started to sow the seeds. I was trying to play the game and I was trying to be liked by the teachers and I was trying to be whatever. The more I went through that process, the more I realised that they were sort of trying to mould me into someone that was going to wear a suit and get a job as a lawyer. And that probably wasn't going to work for me.
It's quite astute to know as a kid that you're not going to be that person who's able to wear a suit and be a lawyer. You sensed it, did you?
I don't know if I knew that then. I've kind of followed the path of least resistance because I started doing musical theatre-y things when I was at school in the summer holidays. And that was just so much more fun and interesting to me. Like, I just couldn't see why I'd be... The whole rest of term time was a sort of waste of, like, kind of exams and nonsense, and then suddenly there's this amazing thing that you do in the summer where you get to show off and wear costumes and all that. I was like, why am I doing anything else? I knew I wanted to be in that world, but wasn't quite sure how. And actually I did radio first, so I did a lot of student radio and things like that because I wanted to just do something where...
Well, you were a talker.
I'm a talker. I like to speak.
You went to where you could talk. What were your family like? Did they encourage this musical theatre thing? Who was the kind of enabler of that?
Oh, yeah, mum and dad have always just been like, yeah, cool, whatever. And
wow.
I remember every Wednesday I would go to do a work experience at a radio station in Lichfield.
Can I ask how old you were, Joe? Sorry.
Yeah, 60. It was 16, 17, 18, around that time. So you had Wednesday afternoons off to do some extracurricular stuff. Mm-hmm. And most people just went and like smoked fags somewhere and said that they were doing, they're helping the nan or something. In some ways, wish I'd done the same. But ended up going to this radio station every Wednesday. Ended up co-hosting with a guy called Tango, who was an amazing, wonderful man, very inspiring and very funny. And my dad would always come and collect me afterwards and drive me home, which was a good, you know, hour and a half, 2 hour round trip for him to come and do that. But always very supportive. And the same from mum, really. Always very excited about whatever I was up to and anything that sort of was bringing me joy was bringing them joy. So there's been no resistance from them, which was potentially, if it had gone another way, terrible parenting, but it worked out all right.
Yeah, yeah. And when did you realise that you were queer, I suppose? And did they realise first?
I remember around that time when I was doing those shows at, in the theatre in the summers, that there were kind of camp people around and openly out people, and they weren't at school. Yeah. And I remember sort of finding boys attractive and thinking, oh, well, I'm probably gay then, aren't I? Sort of, and it was a dark realisation. I remember at the time thinking, like, this is bad. Like, this is not good news. And trying to sort of think my way out of it. And I originally came out as gay and then backpedaled very quickly when I realised, oh, but women are fit, aren't they? So ended up sort of being bisexual. And then I talk about being pansexual in my stand-up, which is a word that I also use for myself, but it's a more kind of intellectual description of how I feel about myself. Bi is the kind of popular word, I would say, that most people understand, but pansexual is the kind of word that makes the most sense to me. But then I've started using queer a lot more recently because I think it sort of encompasses that diversity that I was talking about of like, it's not only like a sexual attraction thing, it's a sort of, it does filter more into my identity as someone that is unusual, I suppose, and someone that likes to mess around with the norms of society and things like that, but in a kind of fun way, I suppose. Like, I think that's what I like about queer is like, it's like, oh, how queer, how unusual, how exciting. Yeah. It's not like he's a wrong'un.
I want to look up the dictionary definition of queer. I haven't done that. Have I?
Well, it is to some elder gaze, it's still contentious because it was used as a slur.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
I do occasionally get messages from people saying, like, "I wish you'd stop using that word," but I won't. but thanks for your message, but I won't. I think it's one of those where it feels so accurate for me that I'm happy to be called it.
It's a nice kind of umbrella term, isn't it, for everything?
But it wasn't in the old days. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Joe Lycett there. He also talked about his childhood and becoming a comedian, a funny encounter with Nadine Dorries at the BAFTAs, and losing his friend and the perspective that gave him, which prompted him to do more creative things, including making a coffee table book of bins. There's only one Joe Lycett, That book has happened, by the way, and it has been released. I believe it is sold out, but I did want to revisit his enthusiasm for bins here now that it's out in the world.
I'm obsessed with bins, Annie.
I love the idea of really trying to dig deep into that obsession with bins. Like, where the hell does that come from?
I don't know, but I love them. I've got this wall. I can just see now, like, hundreds of bins on my wall, and they bring me such joy. Don't know what it is. Just think that I love the word bin. I love... They're everywhere. You're never far from a bin. And someone's had to design it. Someone's had to put it together. Love it. And there's a very
That's what I call the holiday inns. I call them holiday bins.
Lovely.
They're kind of bins for human beings, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Holiday bins.
We do get out of them at the end.
Also,
of the morning.
Can we discuss Travelodge?
Mm-hmm.
If it's Travelodge, there should be two L's. It's Travelodge.
Is it all one word?
It's all one word. So they've gone with Travelodge. Or Travelodge?
Yeah, that's not okay.
Travelodge.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's not okay, you're right.
It's just not okay.
I like how pedantic you are about that. I agree.
Amazing. You can now see Joe Lycett every Friday evening at 10 p.m. on Channel 4 with his new show, Late Night Lycett. It's a live show from Birmingham with guests and lots of silliness. And of course, listen back to the Full Changes episode if you fancy as well.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Our second guest we are revisiting today is seven-time Grammy Award-winning producer Mark Ronson. Known for working with people like Amy Winehouse, Lily Allen, Adele, Lady Gaga, Miley Cyrus, Queens of the Stone Age and Bruno Mars, who he collaborated with for his single Uptown Funk. Mark experienced big change as a child because he was born in London but then moved to New York at the age of 7 after his parents divorced. It was great to sit down and have a long conversation with him and really find out about his life and career. We're going to jump in when he talks about his transition from being a DJ to a producer.
I remember DJing Kanye's Grammy party for the second album, I guess Late Registration. Mm. And I remember I was rocking it and he's like standing on the DJ booth or like nearby with the friends around. And he's like, this is Mark Ronson. Like whenever you see Mark Ronson on the turntables, like at one of my parties, you know, we're having the best time because he's, and he was paying me such a compliment.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I wanted to be where he was and taken seriously as a producer. But so like, I remember thinking like, Kanye's paying me this huge compliment. But actually inside, I'm like, damn, no, like this is how far away I've gotten that like the guy who's doing what I want to do just sees me as his DJ.
But obviously, wow, yeah.
But, you know, like you can't get mad that somebody doesn't know you're a producer because you haven't made a record anyone's heard. Like, it's just like, you know, so you have to just get there.
Yeah, yeah. And we got there. You got there. I think we can all agree.
You pretty much got there.
What have you learned about yourself in being a music producer over the years?
I get to work with some, you know, pretty incredible people. I don't just mean like how famous or successful they are. I just mean like all these artists from Yeba to Josh Homme, Q-Tip to King Princess. These are like very touch, very smart, very in tune, in whatever way they're in tune. So you're always going to learn something being around those kind of brains, you know, and they're looking to learn something from you too some of the time. But oh, I'm a sponge. Like, I'm still a sponge. So I'm always learning. I mean, if I had to say learn about myself, what do I know about myself? I think I'm a good listener. I think people feel safe going into their feelings around me, which is a good thing to have if you're a producer, because you're looking for people to be vulnerable in their music.
Yeah, I think that's a thing a lot of people don't know about or think about when it comes to kind of the daily grind of being a music producer. It's actually quite emotionally taxing. And I know this because I'm married to one. Yeah. And he comes home at the end of the day and I'm like, babe, let's go out for dinner. I want to go see some friends. And he's like, no, I've just been around people all day. Like, all I want to do is sit on my arse and eat dinner and like hang out with my family. That's me. I'm good. You know, a lot of the time there's people like they've never met. He has to come in, make them feel at home, like, connect with them. As you say, make them feel comfortable so that they feel okay about pouring out their emotions, helping them figure out how to express those emotions, then building a mood around those emotions with them in the room. It's a lot.
It's a lot. And when I work on my own records, it's like a bit easier because it's like, okay, I'm the captain of the ship. I get to be the, you know, the emotionally sensitive, fragile person, or at least I'm the boss. But yeah, when you're working with somebody else on their record, you are like set to receive. You're an empath. You're there. It's like a child running around in a room and you're just there to constantly like catch them if they fall, just to be and receptive to any idea they might have, or to pull something out of somebody and to completely set yourself to their wavelength or their energy. It's not what everybody has to do. It's just the way that I've got the best results.
Yeah. It's actually, when you describe it like that, exceptional practice for parenting, for good parenting, when you're supposed to put the kid first and just like react to them and follow them and let them lead. It's that vibe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So with that in mind, like, why do you think you're so good at it? Because you are good at it. You know, you've worked with the greats. You've allowed amazing, iconic albums to happen.
I think that there's two sides. So I think I'm probably a good listener and that kind of thing because I grew up in a kind of like hectic house where I was always trying to be the peacemaker probably and be the listener and maybe not, that kind of thing. And then I also probably like there's something that could be a negative of that. Like it could be probably, I'm sure, a little bit people pleasy as well and that kind of thing where you just constantly want everybody to feel good and things to be okay. But some of that stuff has probably honestly served me well in my job as, you know, but I think it's about, as you become aware of those patterns, it's about distilling. It's like, okay, well, how much can I phase out this thing that's probably not that healthy? Because, you know, in the past few years, I've really done a lot of, I guess, work is the word, because the way that I was going and the level of drive and workaholism and all this stuff, what I was doing to my life was just not healthy and was no real way to live a life. So you're like, but also this is the thing that's got me here, so how do I actually figure out what the bad habits are, what the good ones, and distill it? So, and then you just realize like actually those things, like, you can let go. It's not like you're suddenly going to forget how to stop making music because you're just trying to be a bit more of a balanced human.
So when you say like the things that you are cutting out and changing in order to become more balanced, what are they? Like, because I noticed with you when I've worked with you in the past, you're always like nomadic from place to place to place to place.
Yeah, I think, again, that was because work was by far the most important thing in my life. And probably thinking like, well, if I don't go to this place and I'm not in LA where the center of the musical universe is, and then I'm not going to be there for that call that comes from blah, blah, blah. And also because work was this reliable, well, no matter what else happens in my relationships and all this thing, work is always here for me. And I think even becoming a producer for me was in some ways like coming up from a slightly, you know, just hectic and the childhood that I had. I think that I found this job where the description is like, I am alone in a room and nobody can fuck with me or tell me what's going on. You know, it's like there's probably some kind of correlation between that as well. So a big change has been moving back to New York. It's funny that that's my big adult life change and my big childhood life change in a way, even though I've only been back in New York for a year. Yeah, just there's some kind of decision that like instead of running around and chasing work, and I'm going to set some roots and water the ground where I live, as opposed to trying to just run and be afraid that if I'm not in the right place, I'm not going to, you know, get the gig or whatever it is.
It's such an amazing transition that when it happens, I think, when you kind of take control, feeling like if you don't do the job, you're not going to be able to progress. The momentum will die off. People will stop caring. The work will stop. And then it's kind of redefining your idea of what success is. So it's this idea of success being accolades and bigger names and bigger lineups and bigger everything, up, 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 rather than success actually being stillness and your own sense of peace being a successful thing.
Absolutely. And that was the thing moving back to New York, because to the people listening, I mean, I'm sure in New York, it doesn't sound like I moved to like the middle of like Arkansas, but you know, for most people who might not know, LA is definitely the center of the musical. 92% of songwriters and artists and people all live out there in New York, which used to be such a vibrant place and always will be in some ways because it's New York and it's so inspiring, has been a little bit of more of a wasteland for like music. But I'd rather, you know, live in the place where my like spiritual self and the thing is like feels most fulfilled and psyched to be in, and not worry about the other stuff and just like make the best music that I can.
And how's it been since you've made that decision?
Terrible. I can't. No one's answering the phone call. It's like they forgot I even lived ever. Got it. Uptown Funk was only, it was only 2014. It's only 8 years ago, guys. Nothing Breaks Like
I
a Heart was like.
I wasn't invited to the Brits. What the fuck?
I know. Come on. Let me present like best like kazoo solo. I don't know. No. So it's been amazing, actually. It's hard because, you know, I love London and I was born there. My dad, my siblings, my stepmom, I have so much family. I care for it so much. And then even living in L.A. wasn't my favorite, but I have family there too. But I think I had to leave New York to realize how much I am sort of a native New Yorker, and coming back over the past few years, I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is where I need to, this is where I want to live, hopefully for the rest of my life. Let's see. So since being back, that's been great from that level. And even musically, you know, I'm back in the studio where this is, funnily enough, the place where I was in like 2005 to 2008. So where I first met Amy, like in this room, you know, this is where we did all of Version.
Hi, it's rolling.
I'm sorry, Charlie Murphy. I was having too much fun.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Nobody gave a fuck who I was at all, and I was just with Santi Gold and Daniel Merriweather and Lily Allen and just making records with friends. So it's kind of nice to be back in this room where I was doing stuff in a very like creative, prolific period where I had nothing to prove and was just making the stuff that I love, because that's a good place to get back to when you're, you know, as I'm kind of working on this album right now and working on music. And there are really interesting people, from, you know, Travis Scott to Daniel Caesar to, you know, a lot of people like love New York again because it's like an underdog city and it's not where everybody is.
Right.
So people are coming back here to make records, and so I've been enjoying that.
Mark Ronson, man, he seems to be in such a happy place. He's now married to his second wife, Grace Gummer, Meryl Streep's daughter, and I know they have a child together as well. In this episode, he also talked to me about growing up, his relationship with his family, getting into music, heartbreak, and how his wants and needs are changing as he's growing older. It's a really interesting episode. So that's it from us this week. Do listen back to the full episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening and continuing to listen to Changes. It means the world. And we are going to be back next week with a whole new series of Changes. Do subscribe so you have it ready to go as soon as it drops. We've got plenty more wonderful guests to come, I promise. Enjoy the rest of Easter, and you'll hear from me next week.